Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host today, Monica Hadley, and our guest, Matt Goldman, author of The Murder Show. Matt is a New York Times bestselling author, a playwright, and an Emmy Award-winning television writer for Seinfeld, Ellen, and other shows. His debut novel, Gone to Dust, has been nominated for the Seamus and Nero Awards and was a Lariat Adult Fiction Reading List selection. Matt lives in Minnesota with his wife, pets, and whatever children happen to be around. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Matt.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you wrote for television and then turned to novel writing, or was it kind of a simultaneous thing?
Yeah. No, I wrote for television for 30 years before I wrote my first novel.
Oh, wow.
So quite a while.
And yeah. Why did you decide to make that switch?
You know, I had always wanted to write books, always. It's my favorite medium. But in TV, they keep you pretty busy and they pay you well, and I just didn't have much time. There was kind of a shift in the television landscape maybe 15 or more years ago, where the show started getting very good. It was the birth of the second golden age of television. Shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and Breaking Bad. But they were all dramas. And I worked in comedy. Those were all dramas. And all of a sudden, you know, TV drama became the coolest thing in Hollywood. It had always been, you want to work in film. And if you can't, then you work in TV. But for all sorts of reasons in the business and financing and distribution of films, a lot of that talent moved into television and started making these great shows. But again, it was all drama. And so the comedy people wanted to be as cool as the drama people. So by people, I mean the executives mostly. So they started to change what they wanted. They wanted comedy to be slicker and cooler and hipper. And you know, there's one thing about comedy, it's not cool. I mean, those characters are not cool people, all the way back to like Jackie Gleason playing Ralph Crampton and Lucille Ball and Fraser Crane and George Costanza. They're all a bunch of idiots, really. But we love them because there's just something very human about their faults. When the executives and start of comedy started to move comedy into a slicker, hipper, less human way, I lost interest in writing comedy after all those years. And so I thought, I will write drama instead. And to do my homework for drama, to become a drama writer, I started reading crime fiction. I've always been a huge reader. I just was kind of a literary fiction snob. I'd see crime fiction books in the airport. You know, they had big, I called them big font books because they always had giant titles like Gone Girl.
Like The Murder Show.
Yeah. Well, now here I am. But that's the way I got here, because what I found when I started reading crime fiction was the last thing I expected, which was, oh, when you have a crime at the center of your story, a dead body or a missing person, there's kind of a built-in engine to the story, because things are going to just move along. Your characters don't have to carry the whole weight. The phone's going to ring and someone's going to say, we got the prints off the gun, or whatever the thing is. It just moves forward, and it kind of frees up some space for your characters to just be people, and you can focus on them and their relationships. And that's what I was missing from comedy. And so I had a 4-month break between television shows. This was back in 2015. And I just sat down and, with not much of a plan, wrote Gone to Dust. And it changed my life.
Wow. Now, were you
now I have big fun books.
Now you have big fun books. And were you immediately able to get an agent, get a publisher and so forth because of your reputation as a TV writer? Or
well, I didn't tell my Hollywood agents about it because I thought if I do, they will somehow put their stink on it. They'll try to make it a TV show before it's a book. They'll like, it'll get away from me. And I didn't want that to happen. I had written television for a long time. I didn't need that thrill of seeing my name on the screen. I really wanted it to be a book. So I blind queried agents in New York and a couple were interested. I chose one and I would say within 2 months, I had a deal for 2 books.
Wow. Well, it sounds like an overnight success story, except that you had 30 years of writing practice
except
before
that. Yes. Other than that.
Yes. And it's interesting because in writing books, comic books are really difficult, aren't they? Like if you had just switched to writing comedy.
Books.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that is very difficult. But putting humor in books in a dramatic story is actually a wonderful thing to do because that is often a human being's reaction to a stressful situation is humor. And any drama I read or watch on the screen, if there's no humor in it, it feels lifeless and not real to me. So it actually makes the stakes of the story feel less because I don't believe it so much. I don't believe people don't. Most people find levity in tough situations, at least a little bit. At least some of the people do. So it was really reading Raymond Chandler for the first time where I thought, oh, that Philip Marlowe, his detective, is funny. He makes wry social observations. He narrates the story, so we hear those quite a bit in his thoughts. But he's telling a darker story. And when I read Chandler, I thought, I see how I can write one of these now because I'm not comparing myself to Raymond Chandler, but I have my voice, my comedic voice that I've developed for all these years, and I can use that to tell a darker story. And that's what happened.
That's fantastic. Now, so you've written how many books now? Or published? I should say published how many books?
This is The Murder Show will be my eighth.
It'll be your eighth since 2015. That's
since 2017.
Since 2017. Okay. So you're basically going at a pace of about a book a year.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot coming in the next 2 years.
Oh.
It's kind of crazy. So
So my question is,
5 more books are coming. Yeah.
Are they, do you have the same character, the same detective in multiple books, or is each one standalone?
The first 4 are a private detective named Neil Shapiro and his a regular cast of characters. The next 4 are standalones. But in The Murder Show, Mills, who is quite popular with readers, and it is the most frequent email I get, the most common question I get at a book event is, when is Mills coming back? When is Mills coming back? So I can say that in The Murder Show, Mills is in a few chapters, and it sets up his return. So Mills is coming back in December. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So why did you move away from writing about him?
Because my publisher told me to.
Okay.
They wanted to see if I could do a standalone And I think that is, you know, series either catch fire in a huge way or the publishers aren't that interested in them. And I think that's too bad. I mean, I saw that kind of thing happen in television all the time where a show would get canceled before it could catch on. I mean, I think Sue Grafton's books didn't catch on until the fifth or sixth. Same with Michael Connelly. Seinfeld was on for 3 years before it became a hit. So they asked me to write a standalone. I wrote one called Carolina Moonset, which I was happy to write. And then that book did quite well. And so they asked for more standalones. Fortunately, someone else, another publisher, became interested in Nils. And so that's how that's happening.
Ah, very good. So who is the publisher for The Murder Show?
The Murder Show is Forge, which is an imprint of Macmillan.
Okay.
So I'm with one of the big ones.
Okay. And then the Nils Shapiro novels are originally were with Forge also, the first four?
Yeah.
And the new ones are, who are you, can you say who you're working with there?
Yes, Severin House, and they are an English publisher. But they publish a lot of American authors and distribute in America. So that worked out.
So is there any like conflict? The fact that you're going to a different publisher with these, is anyone like, why are you doing that? You know, why aren't you loyal to us? Is that or is that?
Oh, no, because it's a little complicated because my editor at Forge, who I've done all eight books with, she made a move over to Minotaur, which is also a Macmillan imprint. And I think it's because Forge does so well with fantasy that they're really focusing primarily on that. And so the crime writers aren't getting the love we used to get over there. So Kristen, my editor, left and asked me to go with her. So I'm now, my next book, next spring, I will have a new book with Minotaur. But they were both asked, both Forge and Minotaur were asked if they wanted a new Nils Shapiro novel. And without seeing it, they said, no, we want you to focus on other things. And Forge didn't want, I think because I wasn't there anymore, didn't want to do it. And so that's how that happened. So it was their choice not to publish it.
Okay.
And again, they never saw it. So
interesting.
Like I wrote a bad book and I'm very happy with how that book turned out. Yeah.
Now, have you written any books that, or started any books that just like didn't work for you?
Yes. Not a lot, but I have. I have started, but I've written whole books that don't work. I've written two of those. So, and I don't get too upset about it. You know, no matter what your process is, you can't guarantee something's going to work. I learned that in television all the time, over and over again. And so, they're okay. They're just not great. And so I'll just put them away for now and maybe they will come back to life another day.
Mm. So when you started writing that first book, did mm-hmm. you have the entire plot in your mind or did you start with the characters and just a murder and then you figured
the
it out?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, the first book, Gone to Dust, this is all I knew. A woman is found murdered in her home and her body and most of the house is covered in the dust and dirt of hundreds of vacuum cleaner bags. And the reason the murderer did that is because in that vacuum cleaner dust and dirt, there's so much fiber and DNA and hair. They've contaminated the scene in such a way that it cannot be investigated from a forensic point of view. So the crime can't be solved in the lab. And that's why this, and it takes place in kind of a tawny suburb, a real place called Edina, Minnesota, which at the time hadn't had a murder in decades. And so none of the police have experience with this kind of thing directly. So they bring in a private detective who does have experience with murder. And that's how I introduce my character. There's a reason for him to come in, and there's a reason to get to know that character with a crime that can't be solved in the lab, because he has to draw on his personal experience and his personal life to gain insight into the investigation. So that's all I knew. And so I wrote the opening chapter with the dust scene and then just kind of figured it out one step at a time from there.
Wow. Well, that's a great concept, just because so much of what we see, in at least on television, for solving crimes is the lab and and the idea that that's very interesting.
I think that was my kind of, and that wasn't conscious at the time, but I think I was just pushing back against television. Like, I'm not going that direction. George R.R. Martin did the same kind of thing when he wrote the first Game of Thrones book. He said, because he had been a TV writer too, and he wanted a clean break. He thought, I'm going to write something that's not producible. It's just not producible.
But then little did he know.
CGI got invented and all. Yeah, and then it became very producible. Yeah.
Well, now that you had all the success writing novels, would you like your books to be turned into movies or a TV show?
I would like them to, if they're done well. And the reason, not only do I want them to just be good for their own sake, but the main reason I'd want it is to sell more books. I'm not chomping in the bit to work in television again. Mm. So I really like the book world. It's a smarter, kinder place. I'm quite introverted. I think I call myself an introvert with social skills. So being in a room full of writers for 60, 70 hours a week, as smart and wonderful and funny as they are, just wore me out. Working alone is a lot better suited to my temperament.
I would agree with you there. I think I'd be there too.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about the murder show and what the kind of the characters and the plots and how you came up with this idea? Obviously, you're using your experience in television with this.
Yeah.
So are you Ethan?
I a version of me is Ethan. Ethan Harris grew up in mostly in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and then moved out to California and became a television writer. And I can't remember if this is still in the book. He worked on Grey's Anatomy for like 14 years or something, which a friend of mine did. So that's how I know about that. But then he created his own show called The Murder Show. And it's on a streaming platform that isn't real. And it's had three mediocre years. And it's on the bubble to come back for a fourth year.
Okay.
Goes in and pitches something to the network. They don't like it. This is backstory.
Right.
And then they say, come back in a month. But the Writers Guild strike happens then. So he's on strike and he's trying to find another storyline for another season of his show. And he's at that age where if you're not creating and running your own shows, you're kind of too old to just be a staff member. Like, your career really starts to wane if you're not the executive producer of creating and running shows. And so he feels quite desperate to come up with something good. So since it's a strike, he goes back to Minnesota because that's where he likes to do his thinking, which was always true for me, even when I lived out there. And while he's there, he runs into Ro Greenman, who he went to high school with. She's a lived in his neighborhood, and she is a Minneapolis police officer. But when they were spending their last summer as friends after they graduated high school, they had another friend named Ricky, and they were going to Ricky's cabin, and the car broke down, and Ricky walked to get help, and they didn't see him. He didn't come back. And so they walk where he walked. They don't find him. And it turns out he was hit by a hit and run, hit by a car, hit and run, and launched far away. And so when he is found, they're at that age when an 18-year-old dies, it's brutal because they all think they're going to live forever. But no one ever came forward, and the crime was never solved. Ro now, they're 40 years old, she has reason to believe that he was purposely murdered. And this happened outside of the jurisdiction of Minneapolis, so she's kind of moonlighting, investigating this on her own. And she asks Ethan to help her with the understanding, like, this is something you could use for your TV show. This could be the thing you're looking for. And so that's why he initially gets into it. But as they start to investigate, the more they learn, the more weird things get, and kind of the deeper they get in. So that's the main premise of the show, of the book.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, it seems like a pretty straightforward premise, but you actually bring a lot, weave a lot of things into this book that make it more than just reading about solving a crime. So there's, a whole sort of coming of age arc when he's thinking back to that time in his youth. There's the there's the reason that he's coming here to visit his parents for the high holy days.
The high holidays.
The high holidays. Yeah. And sort of the relationship that he has with his parents and with, and the Jewish community in Minneapolis, which I didn't even know there was much of one, but apparently there is. And, and then
it's not a huge one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And but it's bigger than you think.
All right. Yeah. All right. And his, I really liked the backstory with his parents, with his father. That I found that really interesting.
Yeah.
But why? I'm just wondering where the idea of having his father be this sort of, in a way, small time scammer almost. But then who ends up being a good guy in the end, as he gets older.
Don't know where that idea came from. I don't know where a lot of my ideas come from. Some of them I know, some of them I don't. But it just that I really loved those parents. They were really fun to write. And but he is a kind of a handyman who. And he's a blue-collar Jew. Blue-collar Jews fascinate me, and I come from some of them. And so my dad wasn't one, but he grew up one. And it's just such an interesting juxtaposition against the stereotype of the more wealthy, successful, accomplished Jewish person. And in the community, it makes sense to me that the blue collar people might feel like they don't have a place as much. Mm. So that's who I made him, that guy. And so his backstory is, which doesn't give too much away at all, is he works for a synagogue as their kind of handyman. He's like kind of, skim supplies off the top that they pay for to remodel his own house and things like that. And eventually he wears out his welcome and they move to the next place. So, but I don't know where that came from, but it worked out.
You didn't have somebody in particular in mind that.
No, I rarely. That's only happened once or twice, and I changed so much they would never know. That's only happened once or twice. Yeah.
Okay, and then the other thing that sort of comes into the story, and not an important aspect of it, but it's there, is all the controversy in the Minneapolis Police Department in this time period, because the book is set in, what are we, in 2023,
I think it is.
Okay.
I think that's when the strike happened. Yeah, it's post George Floyd.
Right.
And so the Minneapolis Police Department really
I'm curious about is did you talk to police officers to know what it was like being a police officer there, or did you just sort of wing it on that?
No, I did talk to some, and while writing the book, I had dinner with the Minneapolis Chief of Police, and who was brought in specifically to deal to rebuild morale. Morale was very common knowledge and in the news all the time that how much morale suffered after George Floyd. And a lot of police officers left. They just left working for Minneapolis and went somewhere else. And the numbers got way down. The morale was way down. This new chief, Brian O'Hara, is doing a fantastic job rebuilding numbers and morale. He's really a wonderful guy. So I did have some direct conversations with people about it.
Now, the new chief in your book then is not based on the real chief.
Correct.
Because
that
she's a woman.
Is a character who I set up in the Nils books.
Mm-hmm.
She was always a Minneapolis police officer. At the end of the last Nils book, the fourth book, she is quite high up. She's one of the first lieutenants, like a precinct captain, whatever. I can't remember the rank name, but she's like number three in the department. And so there was always talk of the possibility of her becoming chief. And then when we pick back up 5 years later, she is chief.
She plays an important role, but not the main role. So the main characters are Roe Greenman and Ethan Harris. Why don't you read a little bit for us from The Murder Show?
Okay. I'm going to read, with all mysteries, it's hard to start reading in the middle. So I will start from the beginning. This is the first time I've ever read this out loud, so I hope it's okay.
Okay.
I'll read the first chapter. 22 years after Ethan Harris heard Ricky O'Shea's blood, yes, heard Ricky's blood as it dripped from his body and splattered on the soft ground below, Ethan wheels his carry-on bag into his childhood home. He drops his luggage in the entryway, walks through the small living room, and continues into the kitchen where he sees a note on the countertop. Welcome. After Shapiro's, home around 9. There's a plate in the refrigerator if you're hungry. XOXO mom. He signs her text, too, as if Ethan doesn't know who the sender is. He's about to check out what's inside the refrigerator when he looks out the kitchen window and sees Rosalie Greenman, at least he thinks it's Ro Greenman, standing in her mother's living room. The Greenman house is directly behind the Harris house. The backyards run into each other. No fence, no hedge, no trees, no obstacles whatsoever, so Ethan can see clearly into Ro's mother's house. Ro and a man appear to be arguing, their arms flail. The man's back is turned toward the window. Ethan can't see his face. But he can see Ro's, and he feels her anger. Ethan used to know Ro well, back when they were teenage neighbors living in these houses with dreams of leaving and never coming back. Ro and the man now stand 5 feet apart. They're pointing at each other, shouting at each other. Ethan, of course, can't hear a word, but he knows Ro's body language. At least he used to. He has no idea who the man is. The argument looks like it could escalate into something physical, something dangerous. Ethan is far from a tough guy. He's never been in a fist fight in his life. That's 40 years of never fighting, and it seems a little late to start now. His choices are to call 911 and hope the police get there in time to stop whatever might happen, or go over there himself and knock on the door like the old neighbor he is, just to say hello and tell Ro that he's back in town for a week or two. And Ethan exits the kitchen and walks back through the living room that hasn't changed since he moved out of this house over 2 decades ago. He rarely visits Minneapolis anymore. The Harris family gathers once or twice a year, but usually at one of Ethan's siblings' homes, which is far larger than his parents' bungalow. Ethan's surprised to see the same Sears furniture, soft man-made fabrics and earth tones, same light-sucking drapes, same Judaica on the bookshelves, reminding him that he's returned to Minneapolis to visit his parents for the high holidays. That's the excuse he gave them anyway. The real reason is more complicated and desperate. There's the familiar Seder plate, menorah, and Shabbat candlesticks. Nothing has changed. For Ethan's entire youth, his parents lived like they were on the run. But when they settled down, they really settled down. He continues toward the front door and catches sight of himself in the entryway mirror. When Ethan was in high school, this is where he'd check his appearance before leaving the house to meet friends. Back then, he had no gray hair, no lines on his forehead, no crinkles around his eyes. Now his dark curls are riddled with silver, and Ethan's olive skin complains about life. And he's missing one thing he had in high school, cocksuredness. He was sure of himself when he was younger, a confidence blanketed in ignorance. But then life did what life does, and all that youthful bravado leaked out through the lines in his face like steam through fissures in geothermal rock. Perfect. No confidence, and he's about to knock on the neighbor's door to interrupt two fighting adults. Ethan Harris to the rescue. What a joke. He hitches up his jeans. Why do they keep slipping down? He sighs something regretful, opens the door, and jogs around toward the backyards. This is where he and Ro Greenman met, the summer between 9th and 10th grade. Ethan was mowing his new lawn when Ro pushed her mower into hers. No fence, no hedge, no trees, no obstacles whatsoever. Just one patch of green with no impediment to Ethan stealing glances of the neighbor girl's long legs sticking out of short shorts as he put one foot atop the engine and pulled the starter cord. Rose Mower sputtered but didn't catch. Ethan watched her unscrew the gas cap, look in, and shake her head. Then she did something he didn't expect. She walked to the back of her backyard where it met the back of his backyard. He looked at him. He killed the engine on his mower. And 15-year-old Ro Greenman said, "Hi, I'm Ro. Could I borrow a hit of gas?" Ro looked at him with brown speckled blue eyes, as if she'd received neither dominant nor recessive genes, but rather genes that just want to get along. She had long limbs and light brown hair that fell halfway down her back. Her nose was freckled from the sun, as if it were the factory that sent the brown specks to her blue eyes. She wore no jewelry. She wore men's clothing. Based on their size, she wore men's work boots that were either too big for her or she had circus people feet. She was, thought Ethan, strikingly beautiful in the most unconventional way. Ethan said, "No, sorry, I'm not giving you any gas." He heard his voice shake and hoped she didn't notice. He was taking a chance talking this way to a girl, the first he'd met since moving to Minneapolis. Ro's eyes widened and her shoulders slumped. That is not how Minnesotans act toward one another, especially when meeting for the first time. If you have gas in your can and your neighbor needs gas, you share. It's in the Minnesota Constitution. "But I will make a deal with you," Ethan tried to sound serious, businesslike. "I'll mow your lawn today and buy you more gas if, in return, you show me around the neighborhood. I just moved in. I didn't know anything about anything around here or anyone. He was playing the vulnerability card, another risk because she might see him as pathetic and not worth her time. Roe took a good look at Ethan. He was short, 5'6", had a baby face damp with sweat, and dark brown eyes that looked especially warm above his baby blue t-shirt. He said, "I'm not making a deal with you. I don't even know your name." "Ethan," he said. He held out his hand. "Ethan Harris." Roe hesitated as if she were being asked to do something indecent. Indecent but exciting. Maybe exhilarating. "Do you play Scrabble?" said Roe. "I do," said Ethan. Roe extended her hand and said, "Okay, Ethan Harris. That's a nice enough name. Deal." Ethan hears a scream that jolts him out of his jaunt down memory lane and back into the present. He breaks into a run, and 30 seconds later, he stands on the Greenman's front step. Ethan hears shouting from within the house, Rose's voice and the man's voice, but he can't make out what they're saying. He presses the button on the Greenman's ring doorbell. Once, twice, three times. He hears footsteps, and a moment later, Roe opens the door. She stares at him as if she's looking through jello. "Is that who I think it is?" she wonders. And then Roe Greenman says, "Ethan?" Roe clutches a pink steel water bottle as if it's her life source. She still has blue eyes with brown specks of hair. Her brown hair falls to her shoulders. She wears old Levi's, a navy quarter-zip fleece, Hoka running shoes with marshmallow soles, and 40 years on her pretty face. Ethan feels a chill. Could be from Roe. It could be that it's mid-September and autumn has sent out feelers to introduce itself. "Roe," says Ethan. He doesn't have to manufacture a smile. It bursts onto his face, whether he likes it or not. Roe presses her right palm against her chest. "Oh, my God, I can't believe it's you." Her hand moves from her chest to her mouth as if she's trying to stop what she's about to say. "Look at you. You're a man." She laughs. Ethan laughs with her. He's not seen Roe since the summer after high school. He grew 3 inches in college. Now he and Roe stand eye to eye. "This is so, wow, it's good to see you. Come in, my long-lost friend," says Roe, "please." Ethan steps to the home's small entryway and into the living room. He hardly notices that the furniture is pushed toward the center of the room and covered in tarps. A stepladder, cans of paint, brushes and rollers are clustered on the floor near the fireplace. Ethan isn't sure if he should shake Roe's hand or hug her, and she seems equally unsure. They kind of stumble into an awkward hug, but once they're there, neither wants to let go. The man in the room announces his presence with a heavy sigh. When they part, Roe Greenman says, "Ethan, you remember Marty Mathis?" "Hey," says Ethan, "nice to meet you, Marty." "That's a lie because it's not nice to, excuse me, nice to see you, Marty. That's a lie because it's not nice to see Marty Mathis, even after all these years. Marty is 2 years older and started dating Roe when he was a senior and she was a sophomore, stealing her away from Ethan, at least in Ethan's mind, because he and Roe were never boyfriend and girlfriend. What a loser Marty Mathis was. Couldn't get a girl his own age, although neither could Ethan. But maybe he would have if Marty Mathis hadn't been in the way." That's what Ethan told himself anyway. And worst of all, Marty continued dating Roe even after Marty had graduated. He was that weird 20-year-old who came back for senior prom. Loser, loser, loser.
I'm going to stop you there, Matt.
Yeah,
so, that's a great introduction to The Murder Show by Matt Goldman. And so we've got three of the main characters in play right in the first chapter. When did you know in this writing process who done it?
I didn't figure that out. Well, I had to know a little bit earlier than I usually do because of why Roe has decided to investigate this crime. But I would say maybe 25% of the way in, I knew.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you're writing a book and you, like you say, you start with a premise, you start with a dead body,
mm-hmm.
and you start with a character, a detective, or in this case, in a sense, there's two detectives working on this, one a police officer and one a somebody who's just kind of accidentally stepped into it.
Yes, one an amateur.
An amateur.
Yeah.
And so if you, when you do figure out who it was that did it, do you ever have to go back into parts that you've already written to put in some, like to introduce the character?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I do. I don't outline because when I was a television writer, I learned that outlining doesn't work. Every show I worked on, and I know a lot of writers do it, and they all say the same thing. Yeah, but then everything changes. So my attitude is why outline in the first place. But some people need to know at least where they think they're going. It almost without fail on over 500 episodes of television, a writing room would develop a story, break it all out, write it all down, all these thoughts they had. A individual writer would go write an outline faithfully based on what they talked about. The outline would come back. The writers wouldn't think it worked. They'd all work on it for another day or two to get it where they thought it was great. They'd send it to the studio. The same process would happen. They didn't like it. We'd get rewritten again. It would go to the network. They didn't like it. It finally gets to this point where all the powers that be think it's perfect. And then the writer goes and writes a script faithfully based on that outline, and it doesn't work. And the reason is that part of your brain you use to make an outline, to create one, is it's very left-brained. It's like making a shopping list. I'll get this and this and this, and then this happens and that happens. But if you create three-dimensional characters who behave like real people, who behave consistently, they don't like to follow those plans. And it just seems weird. Like if you're ever reading a book or watching a show and a character says, well, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but they say that because they're acting completely out of character, but they're trying to fit a pre-designated story. And I would rather have a couple days where I get stuck and lost than go down that path.
And does that sometimes happen, like once you figure out how it's going, where you're going, you end up having to throw out a bunch of that you've already written?
Sometimes, usually not a ton, because I tend to write sparsely in the first place. And I can really feel when I get off track. But I do. Sometimes I'll lose a whole chapter. Sometimes I'll lose a whole character. That does happen.
Now, when you do you write like on a as a routine? I mean, you were used to writing as your day job, so you know. I assume you had to show up at a certain time. You went to a certain time. Do you continue to do that as you know an independent novel writer?
Yeah, it's my full-time job, and I treat it like that. So I write or rewrite every day. Unless I'm traveling or out promoting. But even then, I usually do. And I also work 7 days a week usually because I don't outline, I don't want to lose the thread of the story. So even if I only do 500 words for a day, which it's usually more than that, I will do it just to keep the story fresh and alive for me.
Now, you sit down, you use a computer, I assume.
Yeah, I sit in a recliner with a laptop on my lap.
Okay. And
I left the desk when I got progressive lenses. And you know, I had to tilt my head back, but with a laptop on my lap, it's perfect.
Okay, yeah. So the way I resolved that was I have a separate pair of glasses that I use on the computer.
Yeah, I got those. That's what I tried first.
And someone walks in the room, I have
to
take.
To the store. Yeah,
I take them off.
Oh, I have to get something for dinner.
Yeah.
And I'll run out. I'll find something, and then I can't read my phone.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have to put my regular glasses back on to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So now, do you reread what you wrote the day before when you start out each morning?
I used to. Now I go back a little. It's like if I wrote 2,000 words the day before, I usually don't read all of that. I will sometimes, but I maybe go back a few pages and read myself in.
Do you edit
and usually
as
I stop.
You go?
Oh, go ahead.
Do you edit as
yes,
you go?
I do edit it.
Okay.
Yes, I do edit as I go. Not that it's perfect when I type the end for the first time. I have to go back and do more, but I do edit as I go.
It is interesting that, you know, some writers will write the whole way through and they may end up having 10 drafts, you know, as they go back and work through it. And others really prefer to get things pretty polished before they move on to the next part. And then they only
have a
few drafts.
I have a friend who's a writer who basically goes back to the beginning every time. So by the time he finishes, he's done. Yeah, but he's written a lot of drafts, but it's over and over and over again. Yeah.
But your process is sort of to get it pretty shaped up before you move on to the next part.
Yeah, I find it. I like having something to fix. So, I do it. I do kind of edit as I go, but not really thoroughly. And then, you know, by the time, at least with my process, by the time I get to the end, I know so much more. And I keep a list of notes like, oh, since I'm writing this, go back in chapter 2 and change that thing. And so I really have 3 documents open at all time. I have my manuscript. I keep a journal for each project where I kind of just type what I'm thinking and work out problems and things. And then I have a to-do list of what to go back and do.
Oh, interesting. Now, do you write in the chapters in order, or do sometimes you end up rearranging things later?
I do almost always write them in order. I do go in order. Sometimes it's tempting to jump ahead and think I'll come back and figure this out later, but I rarely do that.
Now, do your characters ever do things that surprise you?
Yes, quite a bit. And that is another reason I don't outline. I don't want that to stop. I'll have a notion that, oh, I can take this here, and then that character is up on their feet and being who they are and behaving and talking. And I'm like, no, they wouldn't, that character wouldn't do that. That character would do this instead. And so it changes the direction of everything. I think it's really important for a writer to, I mean, it's their creation. It's not some magical thing. It's you create something, but then that character needs to behave consistently.
Can you give me an example of something that Ethan did in the murder show that surprised you or changed the direction of the story? Without spoilers, that might be a tough question.
Yeah, that's the part I'm.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's the tricky part of it. So, but I think just the fact that he gets involved, you know, he gets involved with Ro in this investigation because she's kind of rekindled a flame inside of him for her. And he doesn't really believe that this story is going to be useful for him in his coming up with another season of television. But he does eventually embrace it. And so I wasn't sure how it's going to get him there, but that did seem to eventually work for me. So,
yeah. One thing that, you know, surprised me a little bit with Ethan was that he sort of, you could tell that he really did have a thing for Ro, but he sort of sets that aside a little more easily than I would have liked him to. You know, he doesn't.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but I guess it's because of his lack of confidence in himself.
It is that, and it's also that there's a kind of, you know, he's visiting. And so if it were to become something serious over time, there would be a lot of logistics involved.
Well, that's
so
a good point.
That's really, yeah. And at 40 years of age, it's easier to be a little more pragmatic about your feelings than it is when you're 18.
Mm. So this book is set in Minnesota. Are all of your books set in Minnesota?
Most are, or partially. The first three are. The fourth one, my Neil's character goes to Los Angeles to investigate something. I have an entire book set in South Carolina. That's my book called Carolina Moonset. But most of the others are. The new Neil's book that comes out in December is set mostly in Europe. So that was really fun to take him there.
Oh, yeah. Now, I assume you grew up in Minneapolis or in Minnesota?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah. From the age of all in the Midwest. And but I've mostly lived here and I live here again.
Okay. So I was curious about why you moved back, because you must have been in L.A. working on TV, or maybe New York, maybe both.
Yeah, I was in L.A. I regret not working in New York. I do love it there. My family's all here, and including my adult children. And so I was in L.A. for 14 years full time. And then I commuted back and forth because I kept working in TV without living there. I'd be there 2 or 3 days a week. And then when my kids were in college, I was exhausted from the travel. I have more than 1,000,000 miles on Delta all because of that. And so I moved back there full time while they were in college, and worked, lived there full time for 5 years. But in that last year I was there is when I wrote. Well, it was actually midway through that stint where I wrote Gone to Dust. And then it published in 2017. And I was on a television show that was on the bubble and did not come back. And in 2018, I just thought, I've had enough. I want to move back. I love the people in Los Angeles. I really do. It's just not my favorite city. It's wasn't well designed. It's hard to get around. I miss the seasons. Mm. And so I don't like it anymore. I had a very romantic, I grew up with winter. I didn't mind it. While I was away, I had a very romantic vision of it. And then I aged. And so my first winter back was fun, and they keep getting worse ever since. So I don't love winter anymore. But,
I'm feeling you with that. I'm in Iowa, so we get winter here. Yeah. And
Where in Iowa?
Fairfield, southeast Iowa. And,
yeah.
But I spend time in Austin as well. And so I, you know, can get away from winter when I'm down there. So just one last
Yeah, that is very
question.
nice.
How did you break into
Sure.
television writing?
I started as a stand-up comedian when I was in college, and I worked quite a bit. I started working right away. They would often have me open for national acts who came through. So I met, that's how I met Jerry Seinfeld and Roseanne Barr and Dana Carvey and Bob Saget and a whole bunch of people. And they, whenever I got off stage, they'd say, "Good writing." And like, I can take a hint. But they just, I got so much praise about the writing in my stand up. And the writing is what I loved. It really was. So, kind of on a whim, I moved out there and it worked out. I
Wow.
started writing spec scripts, which is when you just make up your own story. Back then, it was often of an existing show. So I made up my own Wonder Years or Golden Girl script. And so I started getting little jobs around town and it was pretty good. But then when Jerry got Seinfeld, I knew him. From having opened for him in Minneapolis, he asked me to write on it. And that was really what kicked it
That
off in a
was
big
your
way.
big break, yeah.
Kind of came in as a comedy writer, and the more I got into it, the more I developed into kind of a whole writer, not just writing funny things.
Well, I really enjoyed the murder show. It was a fun read, and
Oh, thanks.
I look forward to reading more of your books, Matt. Matt Goldman, The Murder Show.
Thank you so much, Monica.
Thank you. We always close with the quote, and I have one from Mickey Spillane. Nobody reads a mystery to get to the middle. They read it to get to the end. The first page sells that book. The last page sells your next book.
That's a great quote. I had not heard that before.
Well,
Yeah.
thank you, and see you all
Wonderful.
next week on Writer's Voices.